Good morning, and welcome to the final installment of the NIMBY and the D-Hoppers podcast. This is part three of three. The story NIMBY and the D-Hoppers was written by me, Cory Doctorow, and originally published in Asimov Science Fiction Magazine, subsequently reprinted in Russian, Chinese, French, and Hebrew. I just posted a Hebrew translation of this as well from Hebrew Science Fiction Magazine, Israeli Science Fiction Magazine that reprinted it. Bit of a slow week. Well, not quite. There's actually lots of really cool stuff going on, none of which I can talk about, but I will be able to talk about it next week. But big changes afoot for me, which all of them very good, and some nice opportunities too. And what else? Oh, word of advice. If you live in Britain and you're thinking about buying any appliances, don't buy them from John Lewis on the web. Buy them from the John Lewis stores. Turns out that the web store is run by a separate company and they're completely hopeless and incompetent. Took me 5 phone calls to get my washing machine ordered. Then the guys who delivered it wouldn't install it, even though the guys who sold it to me told me that I had in fact paid for installation. Turns out you can't get it installed directly through the John Lewis web store. Anyways, it was a total nightmare. I ended up having to hook this thing up myself and flooding the kitchen and all the rest of it. And so, long story short, if you're in Britain, thinking about buying a major appliance, and thinking about buying it from John Lewis, go into the store, don't buy it over the web. The web is crap. Talk to you later. Hope you enjoyed the last installment. Oh yeah, one other thing. Later on this week, or maybe next week, I'm going to start with the next podcasts. I'm going to podcast 3 stories that are all related. The first one is The Superman and the Bug Out. The first one is Shadow of the Mothership. Second one is Home Again, Home Again. The third one is Superman and the Bug Out, which is the first and pretty much the only kind of linked series of stories I ever wrote. Then I'll think of something else to read to you folks. There's lots of material in the can. I'm really enjoying this. It's really kind of getting me in touch with these old stories I haven't looked at in a long time. Kind of like visiting old friends. Anyway, hope you have a great day. Talk to you later. There was an oozy moment of panic as the world slurred and snapped back into focus, the thing taking less time than the description of it, so fast that I had only assimilated it post facto days later. Osborne was still atop me, and I had the presence of mind to roll off of him and get it to my feet, snatch free my gun, and point it at his unprotected face. He stood slowly, hands laced behind his head, and looked at me with a faint sneer. "What is your problem?" a voice said from behind me. I kept the gun on Osborne and scuttled left so I could see the speaker. It was me. Me, in a coarsely woven housecoat and slippers, eyes gummed with sleep, thin to gauntness, livid, shaking with rage. Osborne took advantage of my confusion and made a jump for the hole-again Florida room window. I squeezed off 2 rounds at his back and hit the house instead, which screamed. I heard knick-knacks rattling off their shelves. "Oh, for Christ's sake," I heard myself say from behind me, and then I was reeling with the weight of myself on my own back. Hands tugged at my helmet. Gently, I holstered my gun, shucked my gauntlets, and caught the hands. "Barry," I said. "How do you know my name?" "Get down from there, Barry, okay?" He climbed down, and I turned to face him. With slow, deliberate motions, I unsnapped the helmet and pulled it off. "Hey, Barry," I said. "Oh, for Christ's sake," he repeated, more exasperated than confused. "I should have known." "Sorry," I said, sheepish now. I was trying to save Sally's life. "God, why? What's your problem with Sally?" "She sold us out. To Toronto. The whole shtetl hasn't got 2 bikes to rub together." "Toronto? How many houses could we possibly need?" He barked a humorless laugh. "Houses? Toronto doesn't make houses anymore. Wait there," he said, and stomped off into the house's depths. He emerged a moment later holding a massive, unwieldy rifle. It had a technocratic feel, tool marks and straight lines, and I knew that it had been manufactured, not grown. The barrel was as big around as my fist. "Civil defense," he said. "Sally's idea. We're supposed to be ready to repel the raiders at a moment's notice. Can't you smell it?" I took a deep breath through my nose. There was an ammonia and sulfur reek in the air, a sharp contrast to the autumnal crispness that I was accustomed to. "What's that?" "Factories, ammo, guns, armor. It's all anyone does anymore. We're all on short rations." He gestured at the broken window. "Your friend's going to get quite a surprise." As if on cue, I heard a volley of distant thunder. The other berry smiled grimly. "Scratch one D-hopper," he said. "If I were you, I'd ditch that getup before someone takes a shot at you." I started to shuck Roman's armor when we both heard the sound of return fire, the crash of the technocrat pistol, almost civilized next to the flatulence of Sally's homebrew blunderbusses. "He's tricky," I said. But the other berry had gone pale and still, and it occurred to me that Osborne was almost certainly firing on someone that this berry counted as a friend. Sensitivity was never one of my strong suits. I stripped off the rest of the armor and stood shivering in the frosty November air. "Let's go," I said, brandishing Roman's gun. "You'll need a coat," said the other berry. "Hang on." He disappeared into the house and came back with my second-best coat, the one with the big stain from years before on the right breast, remnants of a sloppily eaten breakfast of late blackberries right off the bush. "Thanks," I said, feeling a tremor of dangerous weirdness as our hands touched. The other berry carried a bioloom lamp at shoulder height, leading the way, while I followed, noticing that his walk was splay-footed and lurching, then noticing that mine was, too, and growing intensely self-conscious about the whole matter. I nearly tripped myself a dozen times trying to correct it before we found the scene of Osborne's stand. It was a small clearing where I'd often gone to picnic on summer days. The lantern lit up the ancient tree trunks, scarred with gunshot, pits with coals glowing in them like malevolent eyes. Hazy wisps of wood smoke danced in the light. At the edge of the clearing, we found Hezekiah on his back, his left arm a wreck of molten flesh and toothy splinters of bones. His breathing was shallow and fast, and his eyes were wide and staring. He rubbed at them with his good hand when he caught sight of us. "Seeing double. Goddamn gun blew up in my arms. Goddamn gun. God damn it." Neither of us knew squat about first aid, but I left the other berry crouched beside Hezekiah while I went for help, crashing through the dark but familiar woods. Somewhere out there, Osborne was looking for the D-hopper, looking for a way home. I had it in the pocket of the stained second-best coat. If he found it and used it, I'd be stranded here, where guns explode in your arms, and Barry wishes that Sally was dead. The streets of the shtetl, normally a friendly grin of neat little houses, had been turned snaggle-toothed and gappy by the exodus of villagers under the onslaught of D-hoppers. Mary's clinic was still there, though, and I approached it cautiously, my neck prickly with imagined observing eyes. I was barely there when I was tackled from the side by Osborne, who gathered me roughly in his arms and jumped back into the woods. We sailed through the night sky, the D-arm crushed to my side by his tight, metallic embrace, and when he sat down and dropped me, I scrambled backwards on my ass, trying to put some distance between him and me. "Hand it over," he said, pointing his gun at me. His voice was cold and brooked no argument. "But I'm a negotiator by trade." I thought fast. "My fingers are on it now," I said, holding it through my pocket. "Just one squeeze and poof, off I go, and you're stuck here forever. Why don't you put the gun away and we'll talk about this?" He sneered the same sneer he'd given me in the Florida room. "Off you go with a slug in you, dead or dying. Take off the coat." "I'll be dead, you'll be stranded. If I hand it over, I'll be dead and you won't be stranded. Put the gun away." No arguments. "Coat." He casually fired into the ground before me, showering me with hot clots of soft earth. Broken roots from the house net squirmed as they attempted to root around the damage. I was so rattled I very nearly hit the button, but I kept my finger still with an act of will. "Gun," I said, as levelly as I could. My voice sounded squeaky to me. "Look," I said, "look, if we keep arguing here, someone else will come along, and chances are they'll be armed. Not every gun in this world blows up when you fire it." "I hope." "And then you're going to be sorry." "So will I, since you'll probably end up shooting me at the same time. Put it away, we'll talk it out. Come up with a solution we can both live with. You should excuse the expression." Slowly he holstered the gun. "Toss it away, why don't you?" "Not far, just a couple meters. You're fast." He shook his head. "Nervy bastard," he said, and tossed the gun a few meters to the side. "Now," I said, trying to disguise my sigh of relief, "now let's work it out." Slowly he flipped his visor up and looked at me like a turd. "The way I see it, We don't need to be at each other's throats. You want a dimension you can move freely in to avoid capture. We need a way to stop people from showing up and blowing the hell out of our homes. If we do this right, we can build a long-term relationship that'll benefit both of us. What do you want? He asked. Nothing you can't afford, I said, starting to parley in earnest. First of all, you need to take me back to where you fetched me from. I need to get a doctor for Hezekiah. He shook his head in disbelief. What a frigging waste. First Hezekiah, then the rest. Complaining is just going to slow us down. Let's go. Without ceremony, I leapt into his arms. I rapped twice on his helmet. Up, up and away, I said. He crushed me to his chest and leapt moonward. All right, I said, as the moon dipped on the horizon. We'd been at it for hours, but we were making some good headway. You get safe passage, a place to hide, a change of clothes, and our shtetl whenever you want it. In exchange, we both return there now, and I turn over the D-hopper. You take Roman back with you. I don't care what you do to him once you're in your dimension, but no harm comes to him in mine. Fine, Osborne said sullenly. That was a major step forward. It had taken 2 hours to get him as far as not shooting Roman on sight. I figured that in his own dimension, clad in his armor, armed with his pistol, Roman would have a fighting chance. Just one more thing, I said. Osborne swore and spat in the soft earth of the clearing where Hezekiah had blown his own arm off. Just a trifle. The next time you visit the shtetl, you bring us a spare trans-D device. Why? He asked. Never you mind, I said. Think of it as good faith. If you want to come back to our shtetl and get our cooperation, you'll need to bring us a trans-D device. Otherwise, the deal's off. The agreement wasn't immediate, but it came by and by. Negotiation is always at least partly a war of attrition. And I'm a patient man. Civil defense, huh? I said to Sally. She was poring over a wall of her new house, where she and someone in Toronto were jointly scribing plans for a familiar-looking blunderbuss. Yes, she said, in the tone that said, piss off, I'm busy. Good idea, I said. That brought her up short. I didn't often manage to surprise her, and I savored a moment's gratification. You think so? Oh, sure, I said. Let me show you. I held out my hand, and as she took it, I fingered the D-hopper in my pocket, and the universe stood on its head. No matter how often I visit the technocratic dimensions, I'm always struck by the grace of the armored passers-by, their amazing leaps high over the shining buildings and elevated roadways. Try as I might, I can't figure out how they avoid crashing into one another. In this version of the technocracy, the gun shop was called Eddie's. The last one I'd hit was called Ed's. Small variations, but the basic routine was the same. We strolled in the shop boldly, and I waved pleasantly at Ed stroke Eddie. Hi there, I said. Hey, he said. Can I show you folks something? Sally's grip on my arm was vice-tight and painful. I thought she was freaking out over our jaunt into the transverse, but when I followed her gaze and looked out the window, I realized that there was something amiss about the place. Down the street, amid the shining lozenge-shaped buildings, stood a house that would have fit right in back at the shtetl, housenet roots writhing into the concrete. In front of it were two people in well-manicured woolens and beautifully ripened gun boots. Familiar people. Sally and I. And there, on the street, was another couple, Sally and I, headed for Ed Eddie's gun shop. I managed to smile and gasp out, "How about that fully automatic, laser-guided, armor-piercing, self-replenishing personal sidearm?" Ed Eddie passed it over, and as soon as the butt was securely in my hand, I looped my arm through Sally's and nailed the D-hopper. The universe stood on its head again, and we were back home, in the clearing where, a hair's breadth away and a week ago, one version of Hezekiah had lost his arm. I handed the gun to Sally. "More where this came from," I said. She was shaking, and for a moment I thought she was going to shout at me, but then she was laughing, and so was I. "Hey," I said, "you feel like lunch? There's usually a great Italian joint just on the other side of the bicycle fields."